All right, guys, welcome to Property Profits Podcast. I'm your host, Bryce Kaminsky, filling in for Dave Dubow. And if you've ever wondered how an entrepreneur transformed an overlooked rooming house into a thriving short-term rental, tripling returns in just 3 years, today I've got James Kang on the show from Philadelphia sharing his remarkable journey. James has a unique story to tell, so stay tuned for his insight, strategies, and surprises in the world of real estate. James, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Excited to be here.
Awesome. Awesome. So there's a lot to unpack here. We'll touch on the rooming house because I love rooming houses and the returns. But tell me, how did you get started in this whole real estate thing?
Well, I've been involved in real estate in some form or fashion since 1999.
Wow.
I was a real estate agent while attending NYU, and I did rentals only for about a year and a half. And then 9/11 hit. 2001, and then the rental market, the real estate market in general, just kind of went away pretty much. So I graduated in 2002, and got a regular job, had a nice little lull. I did some projects here and there in Manhattan and Brooklyn, nothing crazy. And then again, a lot of lulls. I really got back into it in 2012. Like a lot of real estate investors at that time, I was working at W2. Didn't know, I knew I wanted to get into real estate, but at that time, you just kind of didn't know what direction I wanted to go. And like a lot of real estate investors, read the book Rich Dad Poor Dad. It wasn't Rich Dad Poor Dad. I read Unfair Advantage by Robert Lewis.
I like that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And, it was more of a philosophy book. And then boom, it that's when I started to really, dig into it a little more. But there's only so much you can do just by reading or doing courses. So I started looking for properties. I didn't have any money at the time, so I narrowed it down to three markets and eventually chose Atlanta in 2012.
Okay.
I bought my first single family rental with my own money. At that in 2012, you can buy a 2006 vintage for $35,000.
Yeah, don't break too many hearts with this story. Don't break too many hearts. But yeah,
so
you could buy property really cheap.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and this is Atlanta, but again, Atlanta was one of the epicenters of the financial crash back then. So, I mean, it was rough. So, I mean, you go back now, I look at some of the areas that I was touring, and it's like a different country almost.
Yeah.
But yeah, it got started in 2012, and, I bought my first single family rental, $35,000, put $8,000 into it, got $900 in rent. So you can imagine what kind of return you're getting.
Yeah,
I
you almost paid
back.
That thing off in a couple of years.
Yeah. And I brought this, and I was like, listen, guys, I'm doing this and it's working. I did it myself. Got a small group of investors, went back. We started buying, dozens at a time. And then shortly after, you start seeing hedge funds come in, Colony Capital, and they were buying 50 at it. They were just pricing you out pretty much.
Yeah.
Obviously, looking back, we should have kept buying, but hindsight is 20/20.
Yeah, for sure.
But we still did well. We were almost up at a little over 60 single families then.
Wow.
We either refinanced or sold, and we implemented the same strategy in 2015 into Cleveland. In 2015 in Cleveland, you're still able to buy single families for $30,000, duplexes for $70,000.
Yeah.
Did the same thing. Cleveland was a little tougher because, Atlanta, we're buying 2006 vintage. Cleveland, you're buying, houses at
1910.
Yep, exactly. So, but cash flow was great. I actually just sold my last duplex this year. We're exiting the market. But, fast forward to 2017, I syndicated a few apartments in Atlanta. LP on one, sponsor on two. And then that really went well. But then a friend of mine who lived in New Jersey, he had a short-term rental business in a town I've never heard of. But it was by the bay. He had about seven or eight properties.
Yeah.
And he knew I was in the business for a while. And so he wanted me to evaluate the business and basically how much he could get for it if you wanted to sell it, and what is really my actual return. And
Yeah.
so I started to underwrite the business and just asking him, like, how do you get cleaners and all this? So once I dug into the numbers, purchase price and what he was getting like as a average daily rate, I was blown away. I was like, are you really getting this type of money on these properties in this no nobody knows, East
Yeah.
Bumble or, town? He's like, yeah. I knew him since, I was like, ninth grade, so it's not that he's like lying to me. And so that's when I was like, you know what, the apartment syndication, maybe wasn't for me. I was looking for higher margins, trying to, make money a lot quicker.
Yeah.
And that's when, this is around 2019, so I transitioned and really dug into that business model and saw that, wow, you could, the margins are amazing. And so started doing research, and I grew up in a town called Galloway. I moved there in 1990, which is about 20 minutes outside of Atlantic City. And so I knew the area very well. It's come under hard times, in recent years. It has a bad reputation. But there was a neighboring town called Ventnor. And I had met my current business partner, who I lost touch for 20 years. We met in high school, and I haven't talked to him for 20 years. And I saw him, his name pop up in the best ever real estate conference that he was supposed to go to, like 2017 or 2018. And so I reached out to him, and told him, like, I'm really interested in looking at properties in Atlantic City or Ventnor, because it's when I look at properties or evaluate whether it's multifamily, single family rental, or short term rental, besides the financial underwriting, I like to look for things that you can't just build. For instance, when I went into the Atlanta market in 2012, sure, I looked at the people moving in, the unemployment numbers, wasn't given a house, but I also looked at they had the busiest airport in the world at the time. So things that you can't just build an airport, so I look at things like that. So, the first property that we looked at was an 11 unit rooming house, like you mentioned. And what I liked about it was when I looked at the macro, it was 2 minutes to the beach, 1 minute to the boardwalk. It was in a commercial zone, so you had restaurants, you had a Wawa. They were rehabbing an old 1930s movie theater into one of those movie theaters where you can order food, and they had like a
Like a
nice little
boutique
bar
one,
above. And then they had just torn down a motel across the street from this property, and they built million-dollar townhomes. So all these things, forget what the underwriting was. You just knew, like, okay. And then we also knew from my business partner's wife that they were they've already approved some business district improvements, so fixing the sidewalk, so that you can have outside seating and all that. So we had a little bit of insight. Now, this property was on the market for a while, and I could see why. It's a rooming house, so it's very difficult to get financing for it. And if when you walked in, it's a rooming house, so the tenant class, they were paying like $500 a month, for a room. Everybody smoked in the building, so you walk in and it, the you couldn't,
Smells like tenants,
yeah, you couldn't walk through for more than a minute without your eyes like watering, and you had to, couldn't breathe. So I get it. I get why people would pass on. They couldn't get financing.
There's a
The
stigma too, associated with rooming houses. There's like hard to manage, transient tenants, a bunch of, hard for the to get occupancy permits, and
All of that,
it's a whole class of buildings. So then you walked through it, people passed on it. What happened next?
Well, I did. I wanted it. I was just, because of all the other things that I had previously mentioned, right? Like the location,
Opportunity.
opportunity, and the old adage, location, location, location. You just can't beat it. You couldn't beat the location. So I just felt like, oh my God, I have to figure out a way to get this thing, implement the short-term rental strategy in this, because I know that this is going to kill it once,
Oh, yeah.
right? So it was almost like, was it fire aim shoot or whatever, it was a shoot aim, you know? So I, you know, instead of like, you know, figuring out the game plan, I was like, you know, I gotta figure out how to get it first. Because, you know, it's New Jersey, strict tenant laws. How do I get the tenants out? Blah blah blah, all those questions, even before those questions. So I called around and to see if I can get financing. And of course, you know, there's a lot of hoops to jump through to get financing for this.
Yeah.
Most people said no. They're like, we don't want to deal with it. So I approached the seller and said, hey, look, you know, they were older, ready to go,
Yeah,
very
they're trying to
nice.
sell it, right? They want it out. They want out.
Yeah. So I had to educate them on seller financing. Like, I was like, listen, you know, we'll give you your price. You know, we'll negotiate, you know, what, you know, once we do inspections and maybe, you know, we'll negotiate, but we'll give you your price. We'll agree to it if you agree to seller financing. Carry the note. They did, you know, and he was experienced. He didn't really know about seller financing. So he just, it's a very simple concept, right? Like, you carry the note. We'll come up with more than 20%. We ended up giving him 30, 35%. He gave us a great deal, 5 year, I believe that it was 30 year amortization at 5%. So really good terms. Because he wanted out, he liked the deal. He was getting a monthly check, right? So that's how he bought it. And, you know, me and my business partner, we went through, we talked to, the tenants and basically said, hey, we're going to do heavy renovations. So, we're going to start in 90 days. So we essentially gave them 90 days notice. Even if they didn't have a security deposit, we gave them security deposit
So they could move
of
to the
their
next
rent.
spot.
If they had trouble getting into an apartment, you know, we would give them a little more. So, you know, we worked with them. And to be honest, 70%, you know, out of the 11 tenants, I would say like seven of them left just on their own accord. I guess they just needed a reason to leave. They were just so
Yeah,
stuck.
cash for keys. You give them a little bit of a thing and they're on to the next spot.
And then, you know, with the rest, you know, we had to work with. We did have one holdover tenant that didn't want to leave, and, you know, it took us 2 years, 2 years for her to get out. You know, she didn't pay rent for 2 years. COVID hit. It was a very difficult transition. Because of COVID, but I guess we can talk about that in the future. But that's how I got into short-term rentals, starting with that property. And it was good because most short-term rental investors start with a single-family house,
Yeah, or a
right?
double or something with a garden suite or something, but like a small one unit thing,
Right.
usually.
So one of the reasons, well, and, you know, I did have a commercial real estate background. So I knew how to push NOIs, et cetera, and I knew what the banks would value it at. That was all in my underwriting. But also, if you look at Ventnor specifically, there's no hotels. You know, they're
Yeah,
in
because
that area, there's like a
I'm
couple
listening to
Ventnor.
the story and I'm thinking this guy's putting a boutique hotel together. Like that's the thing about the number of
100%.
units, and you pretty much had a boutique hotel right down on the strip.
Right. Now, it was grandfathered in as a bed and breakfast, but still, it was still considered a rooming house. So, you know, when it comes to city ordinances, they don't consider it a boutique hotel. So you still have to follow the short-term rental rules, et cetera. Yeah, I mean, do you want to get into how we fixed it up and.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about where it is today. Now, let's jump forward. And you did all the work. You got the person out. It's 2022. Now it's 20, about 2024. How's it doing now? How's the area, the gentrification of the thing that you were banking on? How's that all playing out?
Sure. So when we went through it, my original underwriting, we had planned to renovate all 11 units. But then running the numbers again, going through it, to renovate all 11 units and rent it out, it would actually make less money. So I started running the numbers. The best, I, for us to get in the best, and quickest way to reach the goal that I had set was to renovate five best units. Lowered expenses, lowered CapEx. Also, I didn't know it at the time, but it actually really helped because it limited the number of units to rent. So your occupancy goes up. So long story short, in less than 3 years, because we lowered the expenses, we optimized the five units, very little CapEx. We were able to more than triple the NOI in less than 3 years.
Nice.
So myself, small group of investors, we were able to not only just refinance all of our money out, but we were able to do it and then some. And we were able to do it using only 65% LTV. It was like
Nice.
62% LTV.
So you don't have you didn't max it out. Like some people go to 80 to pull out all their money, and you guys only had to go to 65 to get back out.
To get all of our money out and a good chunk more.
So you still have like a pretty good cash flow too, because you didn't max out your loan to value
Correct.
ratio. Nice.
Right. And that was, the, and so, and also I didn't want to be over leveraged. I just never want to be over, just the hard lesson, in the real estate game when you've been through a couple cycles, right? Like over leverage always hurts. But the
Especially
cash
right now.
flow, what's that?
I said, especially right now, there's, a lot of people were doing BRRRRs really, really aggressively and getting the 75, 80% loan to value. And now they're having to renew their mortgage 80%. And maybe they wish they would have gone 60, 70% instead of 80. But, that's market cycles, right? They'll survive, but they'll learn the lesson.
Yeah. And it was, in some instances, it would make sense to max out LTV. But, what I was telling investors and my business partner was, hey, at 62% LTV, we can get all of our money out and then some. And we have cash flow with nothing in it. So basically, what is that? Our return at that point
Infinite.
is infinite. So why max out the LTV and just squeeze the cash flow? We can just hold on to this thing for as long as we want. We'll be okay. So that's what we did. And now the area, because we improved this property, neighbors love us. We repainted the outside. We made the facade look nice. There's no weeds. Remember, there's million-dollar townhomes across the street. And so, we helped beautify the neighborhood as well. There's our neighbor. He runs two bed and breakfasts right next door and across the street. We have a very good relationship. There's nothing contentious about it. We help each other. And so now the area is very much nicer. So it was kind of a boom area that hit half a year later. There's a neighboring town called Ocean City, which is a lot more mature. The properties are much more expensive. So what you saw was people selling homes there, being able to come into Ventnor and like quadrupling the size of the house. So they came in and fixed it. So that was happening a lot. So the timing was very good for us. We got lucky on that. But the business plan was implemented. It's cash flowing. We still own it. We held a ton of equity in it. We sponsored our first pickleball tournament in the area.
Yeah, that's big. Is it a retirement community? A little
Not
bit.
so much. It's
I find that like
getting a lot younger.
coastal, I find that coastals always seem to attract snowbirds and just people who want to, this thing's near the ocean, I guess. You can see it from there. So, they just want to look at it. Maybe if they never even put their feet in the sand, they just want to know that it's there. So yeah, I like the thing. So you'd mentioned earlier you read Unfair Advantage, Robert Kiyosaki. So let me ask you, what do you think your unfair advantage is? What's something that comes easy to you that other people might find difficult to do?
If I really believe in a project or a property, I don't, I'll give them the underwriting, but I want them to know that I believe. And I pitch. I don't like to use the word pitch, but it's because it sounds salesy, but I let them know, hey, look, this is what I got. Read the numbers, but this is why I'm doing it. And I think that's my unfair advantage is that I can sell them the vision. I can sell them the dream. Because I, And I've always approached every single deal that way. I have to believe it, or I, you know, it's hard for me personally to, it's hard for me to pitch it. You know, it's not even all about the
Got to
numbers.
be like, it's got to come from the heart. You, when you get
100%.
behind it, you're all the way in it. People can feel that energy. They get on board. It's contagious energy, as you would say.
Yeah, and you know, when you're value adding a multifamily, or you're value adding a short like this, you know, you hear about the success story, right? But what you don't see for 2.5 years was the blood, sweat, and tears, and how hard it is. And if you don't believe in it,
You're gonna give
it's
up.
you're just gonna
You're gonna
give
quit.
up, or just be like, hey, you know, sorry, guy. For 2 summers, I did laundry for this property because we couldn't find a good cleaner, right? So I'm hauling laundry back and forth from, you know, it's an hour drive,
Doing whatever it takes.
doing whatever it takes, because I knew at the end of it, we'll find a cleaner that do, you know, we'll find somebody to get done. But in the meantime, I got to do what I got to do, and then boom, see, and because you believe it, and now everything's automated. You know, we have met, you know, we have a few employees now that are on site. So, you know, you got to believe it. And I just feel like, you know, that is my unfair advantage. Even if that means losing out on a deal or losing out on money, I feel like, you know, I can look out long term.
Passion is
Yeah.
your unfair advantage. So, what are you doing now to fund your deals?
I go out and find investors. I also have a nice pool of investors that I can call. Now that I have a track record, I would say I have about 10 that pretty much just be like, oh, you know, I'd show them the underwriting, tell them the deal, and they'll pretty much invest a certain amount of money. And then we'll get financing. I have used more non-traditional financing recently just because it's been less of a hassle. You can
Define
get
what
loans.
non-traditional.
Like non-QM, so you know they don't look at your they don't ask for your tax records and everything like that. You know, you just show them based on the property. Obviously, you do have to show them, you know, how much money you're paying. You know, they're not going to just look at the money, but they're it, the process takes like a
It's
month.
less about you and more about the deal.
Yeah. Now, when you're talking, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 million, and you know you can get percentages below, which equate to hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah, we'll go traditional financing. But that's kind of also another unfair advantage, if you will, for short-term rentals, is that you don't have to spend a lot of money to make a lot of money. Because it is, but again, it's a little bit different than real estate investing. It is a business. So you are purchasing a business. But again, just like a business, the margins are as such as well.
I
So, but
think
that's
some
that, you know.
people, think that they can get into an Airbnb and it won't be a job. But, you know, it can be with the systems once you roll them out. But until you systematize your business, your Airbnb, it's a business. You know, we stayed at one in Florida just over the weekend, and just something as simple as access panel code doors. You know, that's something that's really changed the game as far as Airbnb is like getting in and getting out of the units. It used to be a bit of a hassle until you started seeing these things come into play where, you know, there's no more keys. It's all coded. You can change the code. So, like little systems all the way through really do can reduce, but not really ever eliminate the fact that you are, like you said, running a business. So, as it is a business, you know, what are some ways that you're, you know, raising capital from the people that aren't necessarily already on board? You know, now you're, are you pitching it by the deal, or are you pitching the business model when you approach your investors these days?
Oh, great question. So now, after this deal, I started investing into Atlantic City. I'm on my third opportunity zone in Atlantic City, and the first two was deal specific. So we had we're basically, it sounds crazy, but we were buying like a city block, you know, with townhomes, right? But again, we're buying it for like 60 grand, 130 grand. These beautiful homes and prime locations. So it was deal specific. Get it under contract, and you go out to, you know, if I needed more money beyond my initial investors, we would just pitch. It did help that it was an opportunity zone. So, I did, there were a lot of people looking to place capital gains. They wanted to defer it. So it
For
was
those
taking some.
listening along, define opportunity zone for those who might not be familiar with that.
Sure. Opportunity zone, I believe it was passed in 2017 or 16. So the point of an opportunity zone was to bring capital into a distressed area of certain cities. Now, an opportunity zone is a tax program where if you realize the capital gain in the last 180 days, you can invest that capital gain into an opportunity zone and defer your taxes till the end of 2026. And that's fine, but the power of an opportunity zone is that if you are in the deal for 10 years, when you go to sell it, the capital gains on that, there is no tax implications on it. So you owe no tax. So
Nice.
it's pure gain.
They're incentivizing you to like invest and stay invested to turn the area around.
Right. So, but if you refinance and take money out, it's a non-taxable event. It doesn't trigger you being out of the deal. So even if you refinance and get 100% of your money back in an opportunity zone, you're still in the deal. Right. So it doesn't mean that you have to hold your money in there for 10 years. And so we structured deals in that manner. And yeah, that's essentially what an opportunity zone is.
So that's one of your strategies is like enticing investors to participate because you do have advantage. This isn't just a regular deal. This is an opportunity zone deal in which XYZ and people can bring money to it that, if I'm investing over here or with you, you feel like that's an advantage where people pick you over the other thing because of the tax implications.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an added thing. To be honest, once you've done it a couple times, it's not much more work or anything to make it an opportunity zone. I would say 60% of the people that have invested with me in the three opportunity zones, 60% were it was non-capital gains. It was just an investment. It's still, but 40% is a big chunk, right? That I might have not otherwise have gotten. So, but going back to your question, it was deal specific in terms of raising capital. But then now what I'm doing is I'm promoting the city and our projects. And now my latest project, I'm building a mixed use 24 unit in Atlantic City right next to the convention center. We're doing all short term rentals. It's got two restaurants on the bottom and parking.
Nice.
So basically a boutique hotel, but we're calling it a short term rental because they want to go through
Yeah,
the
the
lease.
city must love that.
Oh yeah, I mean, they actually tried to outlaw it. There was a lawsuit, and now they're realizing, oh, thank goodness we didn't outlaw it because of they're making tax. The tax, the money that they're making on permits is crazy. They're making just
Yeah,
money
I
they're making
feel
on
like
permits.
all they wanted to do was really get justify the permitting of these things, and for good reason. I mean, if you've been into some weird Airbnbs before, there's definitely a scale of, you can go to an Airbnb and it's like a hotel, and then you can go to one and it's like some guy's house. So, making sure that it's safe and it's being run properly is important. So when you look at deals nowadays, are you more of a get the deal and then find the money, or do you prefer to have your capital lined up and then go look for deals?
It really depends. Because we're, I'm presented opportunities all the time. However, I am really, really focused on Atlantic City. There's a lot of opportunity there. And we've been negotiating with a few owners that are ready to get in, I mean, in prime locations that we can go in and fix up. And, a Howard Johnson Hotel, there's other empty lots that I want right next to the lot that we just bought. If there is a great deal, I'll get it under contract and go out to the market. Once I finish this raise for the current bill that I'm doing, then I might go out and create and raise money first and then start negotiating, you know, because if you have money in hand and you're offering cash, you get better deals. So it really depends. And I think as you get more experienced and you have the ability to be more agile in that sense, it really is it's advantageous. So it really depends is the answer.
So for, people to invest significant amounts of capital with you, they typically need to know you, like you, and ultimately end up trusting you on those foundations. What do you do to build those things up? Because we had talked before the show that you're a bit of like of the old school mentality where you're calling people up and networking. What are you doing these days to kind of build that like no trust framework to attract more investors?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because, like we were talking before, you know, I was not a big social media user. It was just phone calls, emails, and you know, people that knew me, track record. So it was that. But now I am, I guess, for lack of a better word, advertising more on social media of what I'm doing, letting people know that hey, I do have some expertise in what I'm doing. I know
Well,
what I'm talking
and
about.
I'm surprised too because you're in the Airbnb space, which has like so many photo opportunities. The unit's empty and then it's full and it's empty and it's full. So when I first heard that, I was surprised that you hadn't been leveraging that yet. But I'm glad to see that you're moving into the more like, hey, look at me kind of thing to let people know that there's opportunity. So have you had any success so far with that, the strategy as you're rolling it out?
Yeah, you know, it's I've only
It
been
can be
doing
a
it
little
about.
hard. Yeah, sorry. It can be a little hard to quantify the success, but have you
Oh no, I could,
found
yeah,
yet?
no. Yeah, so I've had a lot of people reach out. You know, so you know, we're getting to the point where I'm, you know, like, hey, you know, when I'm ready to do capital calls, like we'll talk and I'll call you back. But one of the great I guess successes of the social media reaching out and networking in that way is I've met people in the business that can service or help service my business. Like, you know, we hired a startup out of Liverpool, England to help us optimize pricing. And I've met another startup that's outside of Philadelphia who is it's an additional source of revenue. So what they're doing is they're reaching out to hosts at coffee and they're splitting the advertising revenue with the host. So basically, if I can give you an example, if you're in the Poconos, you're there to ski. There's no snow, but it's raining, so you can't ski. The local movie theater would advertise to your host and they'll pay X amount. And so this company, this startup will split the revenue with you. So I would have never met these people if by going to traditional short-term rental conferences or real estate conferences, you know, but I only met them via Facebook messages. And it's blowing my mind because I was like, I've only been trying for 6 months, 5 months. So yeah, so I've had really good success and now I'm seeing why people are using it so much in this game. And yeah, if I've only been doing it for 6 months, you know, who knows what's going to happen in 2 years? So.
Yeah, 6 months, then 6 years, and we'll see what it is. So that kind of leads us to the top of the conversation. If people want to find out more, they want to get connected, they want to learn more about the next project, the next investment with you, what should they do? How do they find you?
You can go to my website, which is staycoastalcapital.com. Or you can email me at james@jjh-co.com.
Nice. Well, I really appreciate you giving us your time here, James. I'm sure you're a busy guy with all the stuff you have going on, but a real treat for the listeners. I really appreciate your time today, James.
Oh, thank you so much, man. Made it easy.
No, thanks a lot. And until next time, guys, we'll catch you on the next episode.